This is Dish and Dirt with Gary Pickren, South Carolina's only podcast dedicated to the real estate agent craft. And now, the host of Dish and Dirt, Gary Pickren.
And greetings, welcome back everyone to another episode of Dish and Dirt. I am your often opinionated but rarely wrong host, Gary Pickren, coming to you from the friendly confines of Blair, Cato, Pickren, Castellana, and beautiful downtown Columbia. This, the third week of September. So, this week we're going to jump into our fourth and final episode for a while on these National Association of Realtors lawsuits. There has been a settlement in some form or fashion on one of them. But today I'm bringing in an incredible guest. I'm very thrilled and honored that he would come and speak with us. His name is Joe Rath. He is one of the higher-ups at the Redfin organization at the highest level. He is a very sought-after speaker at Inman Select, writes articles, and I saw one of his articles on Inman News, as a matter of fact, talking about clear cooperation, and I reached out to my contact at Redfin and asked if we could get Joe on, and lo and behold, we were able to get him here. So this is going to be a really great show today because Joe is so knowledgeable on the clear cooperation pocket listing issue that is at heart of one or more of these lawsuits. So we're going to jump right on in here with Joe and learn more about pocket listings and clear cooperation. All right, guys. Today, my guest is Joe Rath. He served as former director of real estate operations for Redfin, but last year was named as Redfin's director of industry relations. In his role of director of industry relations, Rath helps build Redfin's relationships with the multiple listing services, associations, brokerages, and other industry partners across North America. He also coordinates Redfin's network of brokers and agents to advocate for local, state, and national policies that advance industry innovation. He also is a very sought-after mind in the industry, being interviewed in numerous real estate publications and appearing at Inman Select. And most importantly, like me, he is a diehard Cleveland Browns fan, which means regardless how bad things get, there's always next year, which is our big mantra as a Browns fan. Next year is always around the corner, right, Joe?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Thanks, well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining Dish and Dirt. It is truly a pleasure to have somebody of your stature and your name and importance on Dish and Dirt to go over such an important topic today. So I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah. Happy to be here.
Well, really what I'm trying to do here on Dish and Dirt over these last 3 or 4 weeks for our listeners is to try to bring as many different angles and viewpoints on these issues that the National Association is facing. We've had one of our industry leaders in our market who's followed them, and then we've had the State Association Director, Nick Promitis, and now I want to bring somebody from a national level in to talk about these. So before we start talking about clear cooperation, which I know is your bailiwick, I wanted to address kind of the big elephant in the room, the Sitzer and Morrell settlement that Anywhere just did a couple of days ago. What have you heard about the settlement? Have you heard any of the terms, or do you have any concerns about what's going to happen now that Anywhere has settled this lawsuit with?
No, I'm left with more questions than answers, I think, and just waiting to hear if this has other downstream effects for the other defendants. And so I'm following the news just like everybody else is in this case, too. But I think it's really interesting. I guess not altogether unexpected. I think a lot of people had speculated that there might be some sort of settlement in one of these cases. And so I don't think that that surprised me too much, but certainly to learn the terms of what that would be and any implications it has for the larger brokerage community, and certainly with NAR will be certainly very interesting.
Well, the case is supposed to go to trial here in October, but there's a belief, I read an article today that they believe the thing will get settled by trial date, which will be very interesting. I think one of the things that concerns me, and I'd like to see what your thoughts are, is that one of the plaintiff's lawyers said that one of the parts of the settlement was there would be a business structural change based on the terms of the lawsuit. And as we know, the terms of the lawsuit is they're alleging that the buyer's agent is getting paid by the listing agent, and somehow that makes the seller pay it. And so they're complaining about adverse commission payments. So what are your concerns about what these possible changes can be? I mean, if we're talking structural changes, is this something that you think could change the industry, or do you think this will be more of a technical matter?
I do think it will change the industry. I don't think concern is necessarily the right word, at least from my perspective, because there's a lot to play out here. So it's tough to talk too much about the hypotheticals of it. But if the structure of buy-side compensation were to change, Like, we've always been a brand in Redfin that's for consumer transparency. So if really, if the jury or the judge or one of these settlements comes out and sort of says, well, the one thing that we know for sure is there's not enough transparency around the way agents are paid on the buy side, and this would shine a brighter light on that, or maybe there's additional paperwork involved to be able to, disclose upfront what that relationship looks like and how it's compensated. These are all things that we're generally in favor for, as long as it's, for consumer transparency. So who knows how that plays out and what the outcome is. But if the outcome in a settlement or in a ruling one way or another is basically to change the way that structure works, I think that that's just something that all of us will have to deal with. And I feel like we're actually really well positioned as a consumer brand to be able to adapt to that.
Luckily, in South Carolina here, we do have buyer agency. So disclosure of payment of fees is required. In fact, if you get paid by more than one agent or more than one party in South Carolina, you also have to disclose that as well. So hopefully any changes to as a result of that lawsuit will be very minimal in South Carolina, because we already have a lot of those disclosure rules. So that would hopefully help us here.
Yeah, I think at the same time, like, there's no doubt there is confusion around the way agents are paid. I think by NAR's own studies, they come out every year and admit as much. And so I don't know if that's like the right path to go. I mean, I don't think that it doesn't always have to be lawsuits that force us to adapt or change. I think it's still between an important conversation between a buyer and their customer early on in the conversation to explain how they're compensated, not only how they're compensated, but what that worth is and why you should work with a buyer's agent. Those are all things that proactively we could do without any of these lawsuits. And so we do that at our brokerage too. And we make sure that that conversation happens early. Like you just mentioned, Gary, that you have, these disclosures that you can present up front. There's a lot of states that have consumer guides to agency relationships. I do just question, like, the one thing we can't be is in the house with a buyer and a customer, and we can't be at the dining room table with one of our listing agents and a customer. So there is some element that we hope these things are happening, but we aren't always able to see it take place firsthand. And so, again, if this helps with that and just knowing that this thing needs to be presented and signed, then all the better.
That's actually an excellent point. I'm getting ready to go to Montreal next week for the real estate commissioners meeting. The United States and Canada meets once a year, and we have a big conference of commissioners. And this year, luckily, it's in Montreal, so it's not really hard, to have to go this year. But one of the things I'm sure we'll be talking about is broker supervision. And you're right. As a broker, you can do everything right, tell them everything, but we're not in the living rooms or the kitchens when the actual agent is sitting with the consumer. So hopefully if we create better paperwork that we can show as evidence that our agent sat down and did these explanations, and I think maybe that might be a good result from these lawsuits.
Yeah, I mean, if there is another advantage to having an employee model is, like, we do have our back end, and we can tell when something's been presented and signed, and everything lives in the cloud in our back end too. So we do have a pretty close-knit sense for what our employee agents are up to when they're meeting with our customers. But I come from traditional real estate too. So, I have that sort of spirit of, 1099 and entrepreneurial agents and big brokerages that may not have the same sense of oversight. But I tend to think that, like, everybody wants to be doing the right thing, but there are, still 1.5 million realtors out there. And so it's a lot to monitor.
Absolutely. So let's talk today about why you're on Dish and Dirt. We're going to talk about clear cooperation. So I kind of want to get into the little basics of it so everybody understands what we mean when we talk about clear cooperation. So what do we mean by clear cooperation? What was it designed to stop or do when clear cooperation came out?
Well, it was designed to combat the practice of pocket listings and making sure that every listing was put into the MLS so that every buyer had equal access to know the inventory that was available in a given neighborhood. And so the policy itself is pretty simple. I'd mentioned this at Inman, where it basically is that if you take a listing and you have a listing agreement, that listing needs to be in the MLS within 24 hours. Caveat there, the exception to that rule is what a lot of the focus in the industry is on, which is sometimes called the exclusive loophole, which is basically to say if you are a brokerage, you can take that listing and maybe not market it, but certainly circulate it in-house without having to put in the MLS as an exception to having to get in the MLS within 24 hours. And I think that that loophole has a lot of the scrutiny of, you know, is it against the spirit of what the policy was actually trying to accomplish? Has this actually increased the amount of pocket listings? It certainly has created these in-house networks of pocket listings with, you know, Compass exclusives and Open Door exclusives and Howard Hanna to some degree. And I'm not knocking on anybody. If anything, I was on stage saying that we would need to experiment with the same thing because this loophole exists. But I think that that's where a lot of the problem with Clear Cooperation comes in.
Well, doesn't it basically defeat the whole purpose if the purpose is to get it out to the masses so that everybody has an equal opportunity? We can actually set a true market value, which actually completes the goals of the seller, which is to get the most money for their property. Doesn't the whole loophole just defeat the whole purpose of the rule?
I think so. Our ideal outcome here is for that to just be eliminated, to close that loophole and say that it does need to be within the MLS within 24 hours. I think that's unlikely. I don't think that there will be a lot of changes to NAR policy anytime soon, especially with the level of scrutiny that they're under. But it would be the right thing to do. But like we've been talking about this for 3 years now, this exact conversation. We came out in support of Clear Cooperation because of the spirit of it. And we know that the best way to broadcast it to more buyers and for everybody to know about it is by putting it into the MLS. But 3 years later, we just find ourselves, you know, being the only one arguing for this and sort of, you know, fighting with one arm tied behind our backs sort of a thing. And it's just become too much to overcome. Like, we want them to close the loophole, but we're not closed-minded to the fact that if this is the way the real estate world works, then we're going to have to play ball with that too.
So why do we even have this loophole?
Well, the most often cited reason is usually around privacy concerns, where a seller does not want to be on the MLS because, you know, they're Oprah or, you know, another celebrity or high profile, high net worth customers. For the most part, there might be some exceptions where it's not high net worth or a very expensive luxury property. But basically to say, I'm hiring this brokerage to sort of, I know that they're big in this area and I want them to circulate in-house. If I get my price, I get my price. But again, that's relying on the conversation between a listing agent and the seller to say, here's what my strategy is. I'm not going to broadcast it out to the broader audience that's out there and someone that might be living outside this brokerage and out of state to sell it. But I have a large network in-house and it's a hot market. I'm sure I'm going to get this thing sold for you. So I think that that's probably the biggest reason that the loophole exists. But it does benefit those larger brokerages because of that, where another group that suffers from the fact that it's becoming more fragmented is smaller to mid-sized brokerages because they don't have the same audience that those larger national chains do.
Which is your true antitrust issue, in my opinion. They try to couch this as antitrust, the policy, but the fact is, without the policy, I think we actually would have more antitrust if all brokerages were allowed to keep their own listings in-house or all listings in-house or whatever they want. Then I think it actually creates, and I think this loophole creates the antitrust, because if I'm a brokerage of 500 agents in a small town and the next brokerage has 5 agents, I can keep all of the listings in-house. And the only way you're going to see the listings is to use my agents.
Exactly. It's used as a value proposition to say that, like, and not only as a value proposition to sellers, but as a recruiting tool to those agents to say, here, you know, we're going to be able to double end more deals because this exists in our market. I don't know how much that lands. I don't know if that really works or not as a hook, but it certainly exists to say, you know, there's a reason that you might go with a you know, 500 agent brokerage instead of a 5 agent brokerage.
It certainly seems to me, as much as the DOJ wants to get involved in these things, you would think the DOJ would be involved in the other side saying this loophole needs to go away, not the Clear Cooperation rule, but the loophole needs to go away so that all listings are available. First of all, you got the fair housing issue that we need to make sure there's no discrimination in housing. This would ensure that if all listings go out 24 hours and they're not kept in-house, that would eliminate a lot of the fair housing issues. And then secondly, it would allow the smaller brokerages to compete against the bigger brokerages. So why is DOJ not on more side on this?
I mean, if we were to take a giant step back, we could also just talk about why is NAR setting policy for every MLS in the country anyway. But with that being said, I think that the larger ones, meaning the MLSs, are better equipped to be able to handle policing this on their own and coming up with their own policy. And it is those mid to smaller ones that really rely almost boilerplate on what NAR policy dictates. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it just, the other thing I do at Redfin is I oversee our MLS expansion and compliance teams. And, you know, when we're expanding to new markets, we are in that very long tail of small MLSs where sometimes there's, you know, double digit members there. And it does benefit them to be able to just copy and paste this NAR policy into their own. But I can't help for the most part, and I think it's probably 90% or plus of the population that MLSs can handle this on their own. Is it the other thing that I get pushback on sometimes is if the loophole is closed, then it really just is mandatory MLS membership. And I'm for that. But also with NAR having so much ownership stake in a lot of the MLSs, you can also see why they don't want that to happen right now. Because if they by NAR policy force MLS membership, but also have a vested interest in brokerages joining the MLS, you could see that as, you know, when you say antitrust or conflict of interest, I'm not an attorney, but you could see that being problematic is what I could say.
Right. And luckily here in Columbia, South Carolina, our MLS is not owned by the association, but in Greenville and Charleston and other parts of South Carolina, it is. And I've made that same argument. Why is the association even in the business of the MLS, considering you can be a real estate licensee and not be a member of the National Association of Realtors? I'm a fan of the National Association of Realtors. I would think real estate agents truly benefit by being realtors, but I don't like the fact that a voluntary trade organization controls one of the mechanisms for me when I don't have to be part of your organization. I think in South Carolina, I think we're about 40% of our licensees are not realtors. So I do see that as a problem, as you do.
Yeah. And you're starting to hear, of course, like there have been the MLSs that aren't associated in, you know, Northwest MLS and I think MLS PIN. And I think that we're going to see a little bit more of that, where, or at the very least, some MLSs are just reconsidering what that relationship looks like and really questioning whether or not this is the best setup. But who knows? Maybe that's another result of what's to come in the next couple of years.
Why isn't competition just taken over here? Why is somebody not coming up with a bigger, better MLS to compete against the current MLS, have different fees, have different structures, have better technology, and change it this way?
I don't know why there hasn't been more consolidation. I mean, when I started, I feel like there were over 1,000 MLSs, and there's something like 530 now. So maybe like it's just happening a lot slower than we want it to. I'm actually just very pro MLS. So, you know, I don't hear as much about the anti-MLS sentiment as much as I do anti-association sentiment, because like MLS people understand, or agents understand, where it's like, I pay this fee, I have access to all the listings. Whereas when the same sort of bill comes in the cadence, annual cadence, and, you know, you're paying your local association dues, I feel like that gets a lot more skepticism and scrutiny from agents than the MLS does, just because it's such a tangible service on the MLS side, where when you're paying association dues, they have a lot of question marks as to what they're actually paying for.
You mentioned earlier today about you don't believe the loophole will get closed. Why is that? Do you think it's the larger associations that are kind of pushing that, and that's what the National Association is going with? Or what is your reasoning for thinking it won't close?
There's probably a few different reasons why I would, but it's an NAR rule. And I don't think that they have a large appetite to change any policy right now, especially MLS policy in this environment, when, you know, the microscope's on them and they're subject to many lawsuits. It's also just that the boards and NAR are made up of brokerage members, and often they are very large brokers. And again, very large brokers are benefiting from this loophole existing and being able to share this. So I don't see them getting behind changing a policy that benefits them financially. So that's the second reason. And I think maybe the third reason is just because it does take podcasts like this and for, you know, Inman Connect events to be able to take what's sort of like complicated policy when it comes to MLS and explain it in a way that is important to people. So like the easiest way to explain this is like, you know, when fragmentation exists in the market, it's just not an equal playing field, and not every buyer has equal opportunity to houses that are for sale, especially in this environment. That's the hook here, but it's difficult to get to a broader audience to actually explain why that matters and what needs to change.
You mentioned that the proponents believe that there's a segment of the population who might not want their houses on the market or have people come in them. You know, to me, that's such a minuscule number of people compared to the number of people who want their house marketed to the largest number of people. Is there a strategy, if we could get rid of this loophole, where we could still meet that consumer's need of, for instance, let's say our beloved football coach, Kevin Stefanski at Cleveland gets fired and he decides that he wants to list his house in Cleveland because he's going back to Minnesota. You know, Kevin doesn't want all these people coming through his house just for the curiosity of seeing what Kevin's house is like. So is there a strategy that could be in place to protect somebody like an Oprah or a Kevin Stefanski from having all these people in their houses?
I can roll with these Browns references for hours. Yeah, I think there is. I think it comes down to the MLS. And again, this is one person's opinion and certainly one brokerage's opinion. And so the problem's much bigger than just Redfin is. I actually think it's like probably on the MLS to be able to say luxury listings do exist with sufficient privacy in many markets. And that can be anything from not having as many photos of the interior to not showing the address. I think there's actually some restrictions against that now too. But you could just show it agent only, where like you do need to log into the MLS to be able to see this house is available for sale and not just open it up to the public to view. I just think that like we have so many mechanisms and fields within the MLS itself where you could sort of redact a lot of that information if needed, or like sufficient enough to keep it private, or say, there's a house for sale in this zip code and it's going to be listed at this price, and then like just give the basic specs of it without actually linking to the back end, you know, tax information or, you know, anything else that the seller is just really clear that they don't want to be broadcasted out there. It just seems like a very broad sort of sweeping policy. Like you said, if it is a fringe case to say that this needs to be applied across the board because there are a small segment of sellers that are worried that, you know, like an NFL coach, that they're going to be going through the house and just looking for, you know, how they decorate or something.
It seems to me they could just make the rule you have to do everybody, but maybe have some exception form that could be submitted to the MLS for approval, such as celebrity, victim of maybe domestic violence or something of that nature. And there be a stated reason why this person doesn't want to have the house listed on the multiple listing service. It seems a very simple fix. But when I look at these things, I always look and figure there's a bigger agenda behind all of this. And it seems to me one of the bigger agendas is who's going to benefit. We know that obviously the larger brokers benefit by having the properties as exclusive listings. I find one of the interesting things of this whole concept, of this whole argument, is that the agency in California, which I don't know if you watch Million Dollar Listing LA, but James and David, two of the celebrities on that show, they're part of the PLS lawsuit. So there's obviously a financial reason that they're involved, and I think there's probably a bigger agenda. Do you see that there's a bigger force behind this whole argument, or do you really just think it's the issue of this clear cooperation and the exclusions?
I don't know. Like, I don't want to sound naive. I just think that, like, I always think about it from the customer standpoint, which is just what I experience. And I think that the market has, you know, sort of accentuated the issue here. But, you know, going down the street and seeing a listing for sale, and then within an hour, a sold rider gets put on it. And I'm in real estate and I've run markets before and I live in this neighborhood. So like I know everything that pops up on my street. I think that could be true of most people, you know, that are listening to this too. I just experience it. I think most people experience it firsthand in their everyday. And I'm not hot in the market right now too, but like if I was, and many people are, and many people are trying to buy for the first time, that's just a really disheartening feeling, I think, is to know that like you didn't actually have a shot at it. So I don't know about anything nefarious happening at, you know, behind it too. I just think that sometimes the real estate industry is just really slow to respond to things. And sometimes they do come up with policies that they think address it, and they get really excited that they've solved a problem. And then when downstream effects pop up, it just becomes that much more difficult to change.
So now let's talk about solutions. What is your solution to the problem?
Well, again, I think it comes down to MLSs, but MLSs are largely, their shareholders are brokers. So at the end of the day, it does come down to brokerages. It would take one of those national ones to join the conversation with, you know, someone like our company, like Redfin, to say, we're just not going to do this anymore. Like we're not going to take advantage of this loophole, or at least we're going to advocate to change it at the NAR level. It takes that buy-in from brokerages and agents first, and then the MLS is more the mechanism. It's like, oh, if this was invented to help solve a problem, we still need to solve the problem of pocket listings. So some MLS policy at the local level needs to be developed in a way to actually enforce that, which is a lot easier said than done. But I think that at the very least, there doesn't need to be a sweeping national policy that allows for this, because I just think that we can keep bringing this up and we can keep saying all the reasons that a house should be on the MLS. But if no other brokerages especially big brokerages, are actually going to follow that, or they don't believe in that, then that just puts everybody else at competitive disadvantage.
Did you see the actual states or the real estate commissions in states passing rules and laws about pocket listings to eliminate them?
I've heard some things being proposed, but I don't know. I don't know how that plays out. You actually might know better than I do of like the ability for legislation like that to actually get through. And I also just think like there is still the court of public opinion, where I don't know how many people in the industry actually think about this or if it matters to them, where it actually could get to that level and not have, you know, a fleet of attorneys trying to argue for the other side to not change it or to do anything there. So I don't know the answer to that.
I'd like to see if we could start looking at some state laws to pass to get rid of the pocket lists. I think it is a big problem. Well, in the last few minutes we have here today, could you see the whole clear cooperation just collapsing as a result of these lawsuits? And if so, what happens then?
I think that it's definitely up for discussion. I don't know specifically. I'm not privy to anything that's going on with this, but I just think like I've heard enough people talk about this in particular as it, you know, if everything that's going on with any investigation or with lawsuits really has to do with just transparency and what's going on in the market and making sure that there's equal access to the inventory, there's no doubt that clear cooperation is part of that conversation. And I could definitely see, you know, with the stroke of a pen, NAR having to change that rule. And so maybe it takes the same shape at a local level. There's, like you said, you have, and there are other unaffiliated MLSs that could just like implement the same policy anyway. But yeah, there's no doubt that this is still up for discussion at that level and could be one of the outcomes of multiple lawsuits or investigations.
And if clear cooperation goes away completely, now we're into pocket listings are the norm. And we're now looking more like a European model. And what does that look like to you?
Maybe it does, but maybe, you know, it changes things for the better. Like I think that there needs to be some mechanism to say that if you have a listing agreement, you need to be in the MLS. But when you actually have a national carve out that acts as a blueprint for how to create a network of exclusive listings and pocket listings that are exceptions to this policy, it's a really easy thing to rely on. So if that goes away, I don't necessarily think it becomes as fragmented. If anything, when this policy started, we did measure, how many pocket listings we were seeing. In 2021, I think it was at least agents were reporting that two in five agents said that pocket listings were becoming more common in their market. I forget the actual percentage of increase that we saw before that. I think pocket listings were up like 67% or something like that. And that was right around 2020. So a lot of people will hear this and say like, yes, something happened in 2020 that may have led to the increase in pocket listings in a national or a worldwide pandemic. So inventory became that much tighter, which may have had people just sort of, you know, hiding inventory in-house. But there's no doubt that we feel like since the policy came out, these things are becoming more common. So if the policy went away, there's nothing to say that it wouldn't either stay the same or decrease either.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes from here. What is your, in your final comments here, what is your prediction for the MLS in the future and this clear cooperation policy?
My hope is that there's just more light shown on the issue, where one of the reasons that we talked about it on stage at Inman is because when you can describe it to an agent where it actually matters for her business, at least even if she disagrees with my take on it or anyone else's, and you know, thinks that the loophole should exist for various reasons, and that's fine with me too. At least like everybody understands what the conversation is that we're having about it. I think that something's got to give here. I don't think that we'll find ourselves in a few years from now having the same conversation. It'll probably be some sort of development, and it very likely would be coming out of either an investigation or lawsuit that at least causes NAR or some organization to change policy, to get closer to the transaction, I guess, and make sure that at the very least buyers have equal access to all of the inventory.
Well, it certainly would be nice, like you said, if we could do these things without having a bunch of lawyers make a lot of money off of them. But that seems to be the case these days. A bunch of lawyers file class action lawsuits, make millions of dollars, and small changes happen in the industry.
But you're an attorney too, right?
I'm an attorney who hates attorneys. That's why I do real estate. I don't have to deal with them. I deal with buyers, sellers, and real estate agents, so it makes my life a lot easier. But anyway, so if my followers want to follow you and learn more about you and Clear Cooperation, how would they follow you?
Oh, I don't think I've ever been asked that before. I would just put in a plug actually for Redfin and the Redfin blog, especially because we do talk about these things and I do write on there every so often. And we just have such an amazing team there too. So all my social media links would be linked to any one of those posts too, if you just go to Redfin's blog and search for my name.
Well, fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you being here, and I appreciate the relationship I've had with Redfin over the years, being able to represent you all as well. So I greatly appreciate that opportunity, and love to have you back in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Gary. This was fun.
All right, guys. So that ends 4 weeks of talking about these lawsuits. As we have more information about what's going on with the settlements, as well as any of the other lawsuits, we will certainly update you as well. Don't forget to like us, subscribe to us, and share us with all the other agents out there. And y'all have a great weekend. Take care.